McGeezy Will Fly, A Grandmother's Journey to Stop Line 3 by Barbara Ryan. It was my first flight out into the wider world since COVID geared up, so I was a hot mess on May 22, 2021, when I began a five-day trip to Minnesota with an uphill task, Stop Line 3. The pipeline, Enbridge Incorporated, has planned to transport Canadian tar sands, the dirtiest of oils, to Lake Superior for export. 31 of us from Northern California's 1,000 grandmothers for future generations, working with Indigenous leadership on the ground, organized this excursion. From the Lakota Reservation in South Dakota, five more grandmothers who divide themselves into OGs, not gangstas, but old grandmothers, and YGs joined us. All immunized, we assured each other. Here is the story of my journey. At 3 a.m., I'm awake and putting things in the car to make sure I'll have time for any formalities required for the 6 a.m. flight. The packing has been ridiculously difficult, especially in my head. Clothes for all weather, waterproof rubbers for wet mud, proof of vaccination both on my phone and on paper, masks and a shield for the airport and plane. Leave keys at home in case of arrest. Read up on Minnesota laws, re protests so any arrest would at least be on purpose. Yada, 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 on and on, in an endless, anxious mental loop. The security line is long, the airplane packed. Squeezed into a middle seat, I settle down with my coffee and oatmeal to try for calm. The guy on my right, however, seems to have asked me something because all of a sudden I'm explaining line three and listening to his lavish praise for my courage. Minnesota is still riven by conflict since George Floyd's murder, he says. Not black himself, he tells me that he has seen the police in his neighborhood go up on the stairs to hassle a dark-skinned resident smoking on the man's own front porch. Next, he informs me that there are lots of white people who admire Kyle Rittenhouse, the white kid in Kenosha, Wisconsin, who went unchallenged by police as he strutted down the street, arms raised, rifle hanging from his chest after killing two and wounding a third. And Minnesota is certainly divided over line three, he assures me. He insists that I take his phone number, so if I get into trouble, he can send his lawyer out to help. Eventually, I recline, moving the back of my chair the full inch that Delta allows, close my eyes and ask myself again, why did I come on this expedition? My own climate activism began about 30 years ago, when due to the nonprofit Union of Concerned Scientists, I realized the terrifying depth and breadth of what was then usually referred to as the greenhouse effect. Obsessed, I lectured everyone I knew, most of whom had no idea of and little interest in whatever the heck they thought I was talking about. Now, finally, that has changed. The word climate is on everyone's lips, and sometimes even in their hearts. Yet CO2 emissions here in the United States and worldwide continue to rise. Climate scientists agree that we humans must wean ourselves from use of fossil fuels, but the oil and gas industry remains unwilling even to try. Their answer to every attempt to limit their scope and profit is, oh no, that won't do any good. If we close down coal in the US, then China will just get it from somewhere else. If we back off fracking, our workers will lose their wonderful jobs and other countries will make the money. And just in case their profits start to fall, they push out more and more single-use plastic made from oil and so contaminant of the oceans that its weight is predicted to exceed that of all the fish by 2050. On April 4th this year, Elizabeth Colbert published a comment in The New Yorker, where without questioning President Biden's sincerity, she worried that even if all his measures passed, CO2 emissions still would not turn that crucial corner and start down, because they hadn't under Obama, despite that president's good intent, because it's so easy for the profiteers to distract us with every other issue on the planet, as they did for 30 years, according to Bill McKibben, when the oil executives accepted the science of climate change enough to alter their business plans accordingly, and yet financed and perpetrated lies and obfuscation about that very same science. Since science does not pause for lack of political will or political compromise, that 30 years of misinformation has caused irreparable damage to the future of your grandchildren and mine. Shouldn't there be a punishment? Boiling in oil, perhaps? Ha! Money. At least money. Lots of money. Maybe you can tell. Fear and fury about climate often have their hands around my throat, and this was true yet again, just when 1,000 G's was planning the trip. So I came to see if the trees and the waters and indigenous culture could help me stay in the struggle rather than succumb to anger and despair, and to do my part to stop Line 3. After landing in Minneapolis, four of us rent a van and set off on a 3-plus-hour drive northwest. Flowing streams, placid lakes, the headwaters of the Mississippi in the form of a large, languid creek. Water is everywhere, in a gracious, level landscape of astounding loveliness. Eventually, we arrive at Welcome Camp, one of at least 9 scattered through the area, all led by warrior women, all faced off against Enbridge. Ah, Enbridge, a natural gas transmission corporation that took in profits of over $50 billion, Canadian dollars, in 2019. With its flat, cleared easements all ready for the pipeline, with its following and surveillance of protesters wherever they go, with its convenient arrangement to cover any overtime accrued by the local sheriffs, a formidable foe. Enbridge has a terrible safety record that includes over 1,068 pipeline spills, which have leaked a total of at least 7.4 million gallons of oil. The new Line 3 abandons an old pipeline to deteriorate in place, sets out for 300 miles through pristine wild rice habitat and under more than 200 bodies of water on a new route, and if completed, would double the quantity of dirty tar sands oil being transported through the U.S. If finished, Line 3 will have the climate impact of 50 coal mines. Ah, Enbridge. A line of colorful signs marks what is otherwise an ordinary entrance off a 2-lane road through an open gate into the Welcome Camp. Impressions in order of occurrence. 1. Canopies of birch, oak, evergreens, and aspen quivering in the sun, shaking in the wind, insistent with the beauty of the natural world. 2. Makeshift structures scattered about along with tents for shelter. 3. Mosquitoes that bite through any fabric on all parts of the human body. 4. Comfortable camp chairs in circles around outdoor fire pits. 5. Delicious food cooked by a large and busy guy named Turtle, served buffet style. 6. Tiny ticks, harbingers of Lyme's disease, one crawling up my arm, another along the lip of the van's trunk, dangerous enough to require the grandmothers to inspect various crevices of each other's bodies nightly to make sure they haven't burrowed under any skin. The first of many in-person meetings begins, and they continue at the Blue Moon Lodge, where we stay the initial night, and at the Big Sandy Creek Lodge, where we stay the other nights. Frequent meetings, long meetings. We've already had several over Zoom before we embarked. We will have more on Zoom after we get back. Grandmothers are good at meetings. At one, we sing and even dance a little, putting one foot in front of the other to lead with love. At another, we fold, string, and hang chains of origami cranes and butterflies. We plan meals and assign tasks of shopping, cooking, cleanup. We figure out who is going to create the art we need at our planned demonstrations and how we will transport what's needed for that art. We discuss how to respect Indigenous culture and leadership. We argue a bit. We compliment each other a lot for all of our hard work. Back at the Welcome Camp on our second day at one of these meetings, a sweet, round-faced guy named Tim Cumminghay hands out cards that read, "Not a lawyer." Give his email address as rsd.advocate@gmail.com and instruct on what to say in case of arrest. I am going to remain silent, and I wish to speak to a lawyer. So Tim obviously means business. But he also says that arrests in Aitkin, the nearby county seat where we're planning to picket in front of the courthouse tomorrow, is unlikely, at least for us, at least at midday. And so far, except for its big, fat, cleared adjacent easement, Enbridge has been nowhere around to confront our group of sweet-faced elder women. Late that night, though, some of us drive back to gather at a bonfire, off the road near an entrance to a path to the river. The elders and youngers combine voices and songs to wonderful effect. The whole time, across the street, someone sits in a dark, unmarked car with a flashing orange light. Enbridge, watching. The next afternoon, behind the local high school, we unload our equipment in 80-plus degree heat. A long blue ribbon of cloth to represent a river, a large banner, smaller picket signs, flyers to hand out. Students are descending from a nearby school bus and we are eager to talk with them, but most ignore our attempts to engage. It occurs to me that we should be shouting, "Listen to the grandmothers," instead of "Listen to your grandmothers," because I'm pretty sure their grandmothers are not saying the same things we are. Some of us yearn to be arrested, and in some moods I'm one of them. But over the next 2 hours, while we march and sing and chant and yell, not a single cop appears. In fact, no one at all goes in or out of the courthouse. I worry that this is a colossal waste of time. Marcy, one of the Lakota YGs, tells me, though, that Aitkin is like the small towns near where she lives and that everything is noticed. Some folks in passing cars honk in support, and a few of the kids hear us out. Later, as we sprawl exhausted on the lawn of a nearby public park, a reporter from the local paper comes over to speak with us. She is friendly, but unwilling to have her picture taken at all, let alone posted. We stop at the Dairy Queen on the edge of town after all this, and I get one of those butterscotch cones that must be 6 inches high, which makes me way too happy. Later, we are told that the local sheriff insisted we had disobeyed court orders to leave the premises. No such thing occurred. Marcy was right. Not only were we seen, but we were important enough that a lie had to be constructed.